This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
armed Zimbabwean police have arrested and detained a prominent activist, and Gabon President Ali Bongo is back home nearly 3 months after reportedly suffering a stroke on a visit to Saudi Arabia.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Armed Zimbabwean police arrested and detained a prominent activist, Pastor Evan Mawariri, at his home today. His attorney, Beatrice Matetwa, said he is expected to be formally charged with inciting public violence, this following protests that left three people dead this week. A Reuters witness saw about a dozen heavily armed police officers bundling Mawariri into the back seat of a truck. He was also detained back in July of 2016 for inciting public violence, but was released a day later after public pressure. Security forces in Zimbabwe have been battling protesters in its two main cities since Monday. They are protesting against a government decision to increase fuel prices by 150%. And joining us live here in the studio is our colleague Blessing Zulu from VOA's Zimbabwe service. And thank you so much for joining us, Blessing.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Well, tell us about this latest development with the arrest of Pastor Mawariri at his home today.
Of course, the crackdown is continuing. Yesterday, the Zimbabwe government had shut down the internet. So nobody really knew what was happening, but we are receiving reports that there is a military crackdown currently underway. I talked to the opposition leader, Mr. Nelson Chamisa, just a few minutes ago, and he was saying that 11 people have been killed. That is what he has confirmed. And the police are confirming only three, but they are saying that they've arrested more than 200 people. And the Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights is saying that they've treated gunshot wounds of about 180 people. So the situation remains very tense. And there's also what the human rights groups are saying, a crackdown on human rights activists like Pastor Evan Mawariri and also some two opposition legislators of members of parliament have also been detained by the army.
Now, I understand that Mawariri was arrested, as you mentioned, for inciting public violence, but this was through social media that he was using a Twitter account to get people mobilized. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. There was a video of him circulating on social media with the president of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions calling for a three-day mass stay away. But unfortunately, it has turned violent. And hence this crackdown. And of course, President Emmerson Mnangagwa is currently in Belarus. He was in Russia yesterday and he released a statement today calling for calm. But of course, the opposition leader is actually criticizing him for declaring a state of emergency, essentially to crack down on unarmed civilians.
At this point, with him being away on this tour, do you think he should be returning back to Zimbabwe?
That's what most Zimbabweans are saying. And his critics, they are saying that this is a serious situation that must be addressed by the president. And of course, yesterday, we also saw two U.S. senators calling for restraint in Zimbabwe. That is Senator Chris Coons and Senator Cory Booker, both Democrats, highlighting that the situation in Zimbabwe is bad. But of course, Mr. Mnangagwa himself is saying that he's blaming the opposition for the unrest and saying these are acts of terrorism. And he's saying they are trying to sabotage, you know, whatever he's doing in Belarus. He's also expected to go to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. So he's saying the opposition wants to make sure they tarnish his image.
Mawariri, has he been formally charged for inciting violence?
We talked to his lawyer and Beatrice Mutetwa. She was saying that he is still at the Harare Central Police Station, not formally charged. But we understand that maybe a little bit later on, because communication is still difficult, though internet is on and off. That's why it is difficult to communicate with anyone in Zimbabwe at the moment.
And what's the mood on the ground right now? What are people saying about all of this? And how are they really faring and just trying to get to work?
It's really tense, and many people are saying they have to stay indoors. Harare, there's not much activity in Harare, and I was talking to business leaders who are saying they are losing about $5 million a day because of the shutdown. We are not counting the amount being lost because of looting, because there's a lot of looting, buildings being destroyed, and cars also being destroyed. So it's like a war zone.
Now, who is doing the looting? Are these people that would be going to work? I mean, who's looting?
No, ordinary Zimbabweans, because, you know, when it comes to unemployment, about 90% of the country's population are unemployed. So most of the youths are actually unemployed. I think those are the ones who are being blamed for the looting.
Okay, thank you so much, Blessing, for giving us this insight into what's going on in Zimbabwe. And that's VOA's Somali Services, Blessing Zulu.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has announced the suspected Al-Shabaab terrorist attack on a Nairobi hotel complex is over, but the Kenyan Red Cross said today that dozens of people are still missing. Some families spent hours looking for loved ones yesterday only to find their worst fears confirmed. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has announced the suspected Al-Shabaab terrorist attack on a Nairobi hotel complex is over, but the Kenyan Red Cross said Wednesday that dozens of people are still missing. Some families spent hours looking for loved ones on Tuesday, only to find their worst fears confirmed. After a 19-hour siege on the Dusit D2 hotel and office complex, President Kenyatta said the attack was over.
The security operation at Dusit complex is over, and all the terrorists eliminated. As of this moment, we have confirmation that 14 innocent lives were lost through the hands of these murderous terrorists, with others injured.
The president said Kenyan security forces had killed all the four attackers and 700 people were rescued. A few hundred meters from the scene of the attack, families, relatives and friends of those who lost people gathered to identify the bodies. Margaret Ojo spoke of frantic effort made by her daughter and some friends to find Ojo's niece, who was trapped in the hotel complex. In the end, her daughter had to inform the niece's family that she had been killed.
She was going back home now because she had given up. They could not be allowed to come. But a friend of theirs, she managed to come in. Then she rang the sister and told the sister, you better come back, come in. News is not very good. Your sister is here. So she came back and found her sister there, dead.
Yasin Jama suffered the loss of two nephews who worked for Adam Smith International, an international government consulting company that has offices in the Dusit D2 complex. I have lost two boys. One got married the other day, he said, and they both started working at the international agencies. But unfortunately, we have lost them. The company said Abdallah Dahir and Faisal Ahmed were killed on the terrace of restaurant in the complex. It says both men had worked on the Somalia Stability Fund, a project to bring peace and prosperity to Somalia through various community initiatives. Jama said he could not understand the motivation of Al-Shabaab, the group that claimed responsibility for the attack. The ones who brought this pain to me are carrying our name, Islam. I'm also a Muslim. The question I'm asking, why are they killing human beings? The Islamist extremist group has carried out several other killing sprees in Kenya, including the 2013 Westgate Mall attack that left 67 people dead. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohammed. Well, Kenya's president and top opposition leader have issued strong warnings to terrorists who attacked a luxury hotel and office complex in Nairobi yesterday. President Uhuru Kenyatta confirmed that 14 people were killed in the attack and warned his government will hunt down terrorists on Kenyan soil. John Tanza reports from Nairobi for VOA.
President Uhuru Kenyatta addressed the nation hours after the attack at the Suite D2 Hotel in Westlands, an upscale suburb of the capital Nairobi.
Multiple security efforts are underway to detect, deter, disrupt, and defeat any terrorist operatives or groups. We are also on highest alert and shall remain so. I assure every Kenyan and our foreign visitors that you are safe in Kenya.
Wednesday morning, Secretary of Interior Fred Matiang'i told reporters at the scene of the attack that phase one of the police operation is over. He declined to comment on the number of attackers killed.
This is a security operation and it's going on. When a security operation is going on, as a rule of thumb, you cannot start running sideline comments when it is going on. We have been able to take out all the attackers who came here, and that is it for now.
The Islamist militant Al-Shabaab, based in Somalia, has claimed responsibility for the attack. Authorities have not confirmed that. However, Al-Shabaab has been linked to previous attacks in Kenya, apparently in retaliation for Kenya's support of the Mogadishu government. An official with the Kenyan Red Cross told reporters that 18 people were injured and around 700 were evacuated from the Deceit complex on Tuesday. The attack began with an explosion, and then there were 3 hours of gunfire as police worked to clear the complex. The president says the objectives of the police operation was to rescue those trapped in offices, hotel rooms and other facilities.
The operational priority of the security services was first and foremost to safeguard civilian life. They acted swiftly to contain the attackers and methodically evacuate those whose lives were at risk.
The Kenyan president warned his government is launching an aggressive manhunt for all those involved in the attack.
I convened and chaired a meeting of our National Security Council, and I want to say this. We will seek out every person that was involved in the funding, planning, and execution of this heinous act. We will pursue relentlessly wherever they will be until they are held to account.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga echoed that warning.
All indications are that as a nation, despite persisting challenges with regard to securing our homeland, we are learning and getting wiser and better with every unfortunate attack. Our goal must remain the ability to completely keep these forces of evil out of our borders and weeding them entirely out of our midst.
Most of those killed were Kenyan citizens. The U.S. State Department has confirmed one American citizen was among the 14 people killed, and Britain's Foreign Office said a British man also died. John Tanza for VOA News, Nairobi.
Intelligence officials and analysts say Al-Shabaab had several objectives in carrying out the attack, particularly as a reminder that Kenya has not followed the militant group's demands to withdraw troops from Somalia. The high-profile attack carried the hallmarks of Al-Shabaab, detonation of explosives followed by suicide infantry. A claim of responsibility came within an hour as the complex operation was still going on, and there was the usual exaggeration with Al-Shabaab claiming its fighters killed 47 people compared with the official death toll of 14. It also was a symbolic day. January 15th is the third anniversary of the biggest Al-Shabaab military attack on African Union troops in Somalia. The attack on a Kenya military base in Somalia's El Adi town reportedly killed about 140 Kenyan troops. Rashid Abdi, regional director of the International Crisis Group, spoke with VOA's Harun Maalouf. He says, "It is clear that Al-Shabaab wants to pressure Kenya to change strategy in its neighbor."
There's no doubt that Kenya's military presence in Somalia constitutes the biggest strategic threat to Al-Shabaab.
Kenya has troops serving as part of the African Union mission in Somalia, along with Ethiopia, Djibouti, Uganda, and Burundi. Abdi says the deployment of Kenya forces in three regions that are strategic to the group, Lower Juba, Middle Juba, and Gedo regions, is threatening Al-Shabaab. Nonetheless, Abdi doubts that Kenya would succumb to Al-Shabaab demands. He says Kenyan leadership and military are determined to stay in Somalia as long as it takes.
And I think the deployment of Kenyan troops there has significantly, I think, impacted Al-Shabaab's ability to move around. So Al-Shabaab would like to put pressure on Kenya to pull out its forces. And these kind of attacks, especially in Kenya's urban heartland, are designed to foment public backlash against the Kenyan government so that the Kenyan troops are withdrawn.
Somali officials in Lower Juba region have recently announced military operations against Al-Shabaab in order to retake Bule town, the capital of Middle Juba region, the only region in Somalia that Al-Shabaab controls in its entirety. Al-Shabaab carried out two previous high-profile attacks against Kenya. The attack in Westgate in 2013 killed 67, while the attack in Garissa University in February in 2015 killed nearly 150, most of them students. Al-Shabaab also has been using improvised explosive devices to target Kenyan military and police, killing dozens. But Kenya has also made significant progress in improving intelligence and counterterrorism, and Kenya foiled what would have been an attack last February. But Abdi says Al-Shabaab never lost the intention to attack Kenya.
You know, Kenya was making progress in the counter-terror campaign. However, I think the problem has always been also vigilance. You know, it is difficult to be vigilant all the time. And this is what Al-Shabaab always exploits. You know, after 4 years of without an attack, you know, people become complacent and think that the terror threat is gone. And I think this is the weakness which Al-Shabaab exploited to conduct this attack.
The United States military carried out 47 drone strikes against Al-Shabaab last year and 5 so far this year. But Al-Shabaab still controls vast territory in the countryside and likely will continue to plot terror attacks.
The Libyan National Army, headed by General Khalifa Haftar, sent its forces to southern Libya to fight terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, as well as gangs from Chad and Sudan. Qassem Salame, the UN envoy on Libya, has called for better coordination between Egypt, Tunisia, and Algeria to avoid turning Libya into a safe haven for the Islamic State militants. Mufto Tayyar, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi about the prospects of success for efforts to uproot terrorists from southern Libya.
There is a possibility that it will succeed, but not without a real support from different parties in the region, especially the neighboring countries like Chad, Sudan, or another international support, especially from France. When we look at France and its interests and its history in the south. But before that cooperation or that intervention, there should be at least a minimum understanding between the local parties, especially in the capital, Tripoli. Without that, it would be tough for General Haftar to succeed. I don't think that Haftar, being victorious in the south, will expand his influence. The influence in Libya, especially in the southern and western part, it's not going to be on the account of the GNA.
UN envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salame, called for better coordination between Egypt, Tunisia, and Algeria to avoid turning southern Libya into a safe haven for ISIS. Would these countries cooperate to protect Libya?
Generally, Libya needs a lot of cooperation and coordination. But the three countries that you mentioned, there is a bit of difference in each case. A state or a country like Egypt, I don't think they consider the southern part of Libya a point of interest for them, even though who is leading the operation there is their ally, Haftar. Tunis, honestly, cannot do anything. Maybe the exception is Algeria, which will be impacted in case of the things in the southern part of Libya became loose and became a harbor to the terrorist groups. And Algeria is very, very interested in not having any source of trouble coming from the south part of Libya.
Salama also revealed that regional and international forces have begun to intervene in this part of Libya. How serious is such interference, and is it the best way to handle the security situation in southern Libya?
The serious question is this going to be under the umbrella of the United Nations Security Council and with the blessing of the different parties that's related to the issue? Without excluding any part, it would be, and again, if it is under the umbrella of the United Nations, this would be definitely a welcome effort by the Libyans. The task is very tough, and anyone now in the south and the southern western part of Libya know that very well.
But Salama warned against intervening in Libya without consulting the GNA.
He's right. It's not acceptable that each part individually go to the south and claim that he's going to liberate that. It's not going to work. That's why I said Haftar or anybody else, whatever he's doing there, if it's not a united effort by the Libyans and by political and army and military, it's not going to succeed.
That was Muftah Tayyar, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Gabon's President Ali Bongo is back home nearly 3 months after reportedly suffering a stroke on a visit to Saudi Arabia. Bongo's return appeared at least partly aimed at tamping down rumors over his health and growing questions about his ability to lead the country. Last week, the government quashed a coup attempt when soldiers took over state radio. Two of them were killed and 4 others arrested. Bongo returned early yesterday. He then appeared on state television for a ceremony swearing in new cabinet ministers. Economy Minister Jean-Marie Ogadanga called his presence a sigh of relief for the economy. In a wheelchair, Bongo could be seen smiling and chatting, but he made no statements during the ceremony, and there was no sign of movement of his right arm, which was immobile during a taped New Year's address. Bongo succeeded his father as president in 2009. The two have ruled the country for more than 50 years. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhibi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
And for listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrius Regis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Stand up!